Dr. Robertson's dedication to strengthen the pillars of liberty and faith, pillars that sustain our communities and our country.
I don't know about this doctrine of assassination, but in Chavez's case, we're trying to assassinate him. I think we really ought to go ahead and do it. It's a whole lot cheaper than starting a war. You read the Bible, he says, this is my land. And for any prime minister of Israel who decides he's going to carve it up and give it away, God says no.
The idea was to challenge the culture in the areas that are most important to people. The first, of course, was television, and then the theater and journalism. And then, of course, beyond that was law, which has such a dramatic effect on everybody's lives.
There was never any intention that our government would be separated from God Almighty. Never, never, never in the history of this land did the founders or those who came after them think that was the case.
By the authority vested in me by the Board of Trustees and upon the recommendation of the faculty, I confer upon you the Juris Doctor degree with all the rights, privileges, and responsibilities thereto pertaining. Congratulations.
The students that come here knowing that it is a Christian school, and that the faculty will be teaching us that they're also mostly Christians too as well. And so I think one of the more unique aspects is at the beginning of class, we have classes that last 10 minutes longer than most of the typical classes because there is a period for devotion.
Heavenly Father, thou hast placed me in the church which thy son purchased with his own blood. Help me to be true, faithful, chaste. Father, thank you for those who have gone before us. Thank you for the heritage of faith that we see stretching back.
Separate God's influence and God's law from the laws of this nation. Even though this man-made construct is simply made up by men who then put in the words of their hocus-pocus books, scripted words of their God that they designed. Just like now, Roberts, as you and company at Regents University are constructing your own version of a Christian God, and then use these Christian soldiers to go into deeper the bedrocks of empire and become law changers, law constitutional writers, to further what is not in contradiction to Christianity, Islam, or Judaism. Capital market imperialism. This nonsense has got to stop. Slave time. Check this. Listening to 103.3. 101.1 freakradio.org with Skid in Santa Cruz. 104.1 Berkeley. 96.3 106.7 Antelope Valley. Check out some Slaves in Revolt at savagejustice.blogspot.com, propagandapress.org, and of course Radio for All. .net, the universe. Tonight, we're going to go into some damnation from some Christopher Columbuses with turbans on. We got all that and a hell of a lot more on 103.3 Slave Revolt. everything you know is wrong. Hello, seekers. Here we go again. And hello, especially to the skeptic inside you who might still believe. And history of black folks is under siege worldwide. Black life has little value and status in a world guided by privatized market-based principles of its rulers, all of which are interwoven and developed through their supremacist theological and ethical biological superior constructs. In this Ruins of Empire segment called Destroying Ancient Nubia, the Christopher Columbuses with turbans on Damn Nation of the Nile. We're going to explore another crisis in the Sudan by the proud Arab cliques led by Bashir. First off, let's start with Ali Askuri, former senior planner manager in the Sudan, who talks about the Meroway Dam project being built along the River Nile in the Sudan. So let's check out what Ali has to say.
Because I believe this is the most destructive project ever thought of. The dam is in northern Sudan, and it will displace 50,000 people, more than that. The figure might go up to 100, because the dam authority doesn't tell the exact figure. The dam also would submerge a valuable area in history, the Kushite history, the Nabatean history. This is the oldest African civilization that existed on the River Nile 5,000 years ago, and a good part of the Nubian civilization was submerged by Aswan High Dam. Now they come up with this idea of Marawi Dam to submerge what is left from this African civilization.
So now, as if enough hasn't been destroyed and flooded out recently in the black experience, now they plan on flooding out Kush, or at least the region of Kush, and this part being Nubia. Now, the Aswan Dam that was built in the early 1960s by Egypt destroyed a good portion, and you had people like Steele who did some excavation to see what was going on, or to just basically salvage as much as they could. But nevertheless, a good portion ended up being lost. Now, the Chris Columbuses with turbans on are basically trying to finish off the job. This dam, its height is going to be 67 meters. It's on the fourth cataract of the Nile in northern Sudan. A reservoir of about 174 kilometers, surface area about 476 square kilometers. Scheduled to be the largest dam in Africa. And it's set to be a multi-purpose dam project. The cost is around $1.8 billion. It's being implemented by a Chinese joint venture between like the Chinese National Resource Hydropower Engineering and China's Water Engineering, CCMDJV. It's financed by China's Exim Bank. The CCMDJV has a contract of $60 million. And these deals lock in with the energy deals that are set in place. Tens of thousands of settlers on who live along the river basins are going to be displaced. Now, where does the self-identifying Arab clique plan on moving these people whose way of life is based off of the river system? They plan on moving them out into the desert. No choice. So here you see a situation where this clique, once again, because of its own privatized interests and goals that precede all else, are already in the process and engagement of creating other disturbances in the region. These people have been saying for the longest that they have basically no hope of survival out in the middle of the desert. The Chris Columbuses with turbans response basically is not just leave or die, it's leave and die. So from the people of the Sudan to the history of ancient Nubia, which is a cornerstone of all early African civilizations, it means nothing. From New Orleans, us being flooded out by Hurricane Sam winds of the elite clique order, the old line family in New Orleans, in their privatized interest, to the rush to flood out and gentrify Harlem, one of the key cornerstone black cities in America, or communities in America, to the destruction of ancient Nubia. One can see step by step how our lives, historically and currently, mean nothing to the various forces in power throughout the planet as they play out their genocidal privatized game. We mean nothing to these Slavs. Our history and our future are of no regard to them. Ali Ascori also outlines the dangers of the loss of the early African civilizations by these thugs.
In the north, northern Sudan, there are six cataract rabbits. You say here in the United States, you say rabbits. There are six rabbits along the River Nile in northern Sudan. This is on the falls. It is just below the great bend of the Nile. That's where the dam is. And it's important here, one thing I want to bring out to the attention of the African people here, African American, the historian, the people working in archaeology, and those who are interested in African history. We have, this is the moment we need to stand together and protect the African history. This is the second time that a valuable African civilization is being submerged by water, under justification of power or whatever. But there is no real justification for these projects. So my own sense, my own hunch is that this is a targeted area to submerge the African history. First one was the Swan High Dam. It submerged like 500 kilometers of African Nubian in northern Sudan. This is a place very old in history. The Nubian civilization ruled, in fact, Egypt for 100 years and extended from the Nile, from our areas, up to Palestine 5,000 years ago, more than 1,000 years ago. And it was the greatest and the first African civilization. Now, the indication we have after, you know, archaeological work, it appears that the Kush civilization is the oldest. It started before the Egyptian. It started on the Nile in northern Sudan, and then they moved northwards to the delta. So it's of great historical value. In this case, there's very little, minimum effort has been put in saving the archaeology. The government is not, this is a religious government, they don't believe in history, they don't believe in archaeology, they're not willing to put any money in archaeological work, and there are four or five teams from Western Europe, from Canada, and I think a team or two from United States, but they don't have the time, and the government is not supporting them by resource. So much of the work is still need to be done, and having the high tension now, because there's a conflict between the dam authority and the affected communities, so the work has been suspended. The archaeologists could not go into the area. And my fear is that the major part of history will be submerged.
Now this gets into this, how sick it is to live in a world where the priorities of profit over humanity, over living resources, over the well-being of the planet, over past human descendants. Now, when Ali talked about how there's no real justification for this project, well, in reality, it all ties into various overlapping geopolitical strategies and interests. One of them is that this is part of China's grand chessboard strategy, which is to secure African energy resources like hydrocarbons into its fold, secure Africa's natural resources like minerals into its network. Sudan, Ethiopia, Angola, Chad, Gabon, Zimbabwe, Ghana, Mozambique, Nigeria, Equatorial New Guinea are key countries in this strategy by the Chinese in their network. As we know, there's a worldwide competition by the various market forces to control energy resources. Sam's major battle in Iraq right now and around the pipelines that go out of the various areas is part of its geopolitical strategy to control large quantities of hydrocarbons in the Eurasian corridor, the landmass of Europe and Asia combined. Iraq is a key component. Iran is not only the fourth largest producer of hydrocarbons in the world, is number two in natural gas, only behind Russia. Sam's various colored revolutions are basically to lock in its competitors like Russia, where former Soviet states who have major pipelines going through them from Russia will fall into Sam's fold, and then Sam will then be in a geopolitical power surge in position to help dictate its interests. And of course, a key component of its interest is to stabilize its U.S. dollar and to have the U.S. dollar remain the world reserve currency, especially as a currency that world energy resources will continue to be traded in. China, in the meanwhile, is reaching out and doing various networks from South America to Africa to try to lock in countries into its fold. But within all of this privatized competition between these various market order societies, this is not about development of these societies that have these large quantities of energy resources. This is not about African development as a whole. It's about their global interest in quote-unquote security. This is why China, in this case, has no problem working with the Arab elite Islamic supremacist privatized marketeers in the Sudan. It's also easier for elite societies to cooperate with other elite-run societies to work out their deals with these authoritarian societies, which only entrenches the elite's monopolistic power. So these things, of course, then end up compounding the already contradictions and exploitative nature of societies like the Sudan. So China is promising to spend $750 million for Khartoum's International Airport. $20 billion is initiated worth of for development in dams and hydro stations, textile mills, agriculture works, etc., throughout the region. $500 million is being spent on new oil refiners. Now, while this is going on, many of these areas that they're building these oversized airports and oversized dams in this case, it has nothing to do with the particular need of electricity in the Sudan. It has to do with a form of payola where the Arab clique is able to consolidate money in their interest for those who are aligned with them And China is able to pay off by these types of projects the elite cliques a reward in the form of these mega dams and mega airports. They're building an airport in the Sudan. It's going to be the fourth largest airport in Africa, and the population is only around 6,000. But the area that they're building it is one of the major players in the little clique in the Sudan. So once again, it's a form of payola. You help keep people from the Arab clique's position. You help keep your cadre liquidated with money so that they'll stay loyal to the Islamic State. And then on a larger scale of from the Chinese position, this is a way to buy off and keep these little client states and their leaders, at least, happy. So this is how this process keeps developing and keeps fermenting itself. When these types of projects are developed also, and you have all of these loans, like $12 million in soft loan monies for fishing projects and all of this type of stuff by China, it's often tied to the transfer of arms sales. China is one of Sudan's major arms suppliers today, along with Russia. These arms are then used to discipline Sudan's own population. So, these are how these aspects develop. Now, when it comes to the destruction of ancient Nubia, one of the aspects that is beneficial for elite rulers is to always destroy people's historical memory, destroy their labor memory. In the context of America, they don't want to talk about slavery, not because of quote-unquote less we're beyond that or anything like that, but it's in part like I tried to go into in the Terrorist Games two-part show on the Colored Bullets, White Bullets program, Reconstruction's End, that there is a continuum of power conflict by the rulers and the slaves in these given societies, and that these things do not happen in a vacuum. And by falling into a form of utopian capitalism amnesia on the history, the true history of these events, you are more susceptible to buy in to modern fables of the American experiment or whatever given society you're in. When talking about Nubia, you really can't explain Egyptian history without explaining or knowing Nubia history. There's more pyramids in Nubia than there are in ancient Egypt. The first pyramids were in Nubia. The first form of hieroglyphic writing, Nubia. Ancient Egypt was populated by Nubian and other Kushite societies. The region of Kush is not just Nubia, but it is an interaction and overlaying of other countries known today as Ethiopia, Somalia, etc., etc. And you can't explain early African history, development, and the migration from those areas into the inner part of Africa and the constant interplay between them without knowing the links between Kush, Taseti, Nubia, ancient Egypt. So when Ascori was talking about the hocus pocus type, this hocus pocus government doesn't believe in history or archaeology, it's basically that these mystics know that hocus pocusism is a political, historical, social construct, and that they want their populations to view the world through their mystical lens, which has, as I've gone into before, no contradiction to the market order. Has no contradiction to imperialism, to colonialism. You can be a Christian and be a capitalist, an Islam and an imperialist, a Hebron and a colonialist. So by blending and having you bend your knees into these constructs and belief systems plays a role in rewriting your history and outlook. In the same way that the imperialists of America had no problem with the destruction of Iraqi history, the museums, etc., because the future that and the lens that they want them to look through historically and off into the future is that of the U.S. Western Empire's worldview and destroying people's history is a good place to start when you're one of these types of barbarians. So this is the process that has been going on. And Sudan, the Khartoum clique, has set up its personal Mirway security personnel. They've already attempted to assassinate a couple of leaders, Hassan Ali Zaidan and Gassem Ala Abdullah. They were part of a peaceful protest to the chief executive of the dam implementation unit. He ended up shooting shots at him, and eyewitnesses' accounts saw this development unfold. You had community leaders arbitrarily arrested, thrown in detention. In 2006, several people were killed and around 47 people were injured in their peaceful protest of the dam. Now, in part, the reason why I mention this is that, once again, this is how the Khartoum privatized Arab clique is always in a constant state of destabilization. When you send people off to the desert to die, you're basically telling them that they and their kids have no future. Just go die. You don't care that they have no means of survival out in the middle of the desert. It doesn't mean anything to you. This is how these types of conflicts occur. Then what ends up happening is that, of course, the Western imperialists will try to use these types of disturbances that are happening within a given country for their own end. That's what imperialists do. But what you do in your own country counts. So just to always fall off and blame Western powers for trying to destabilize and so on, anyone in their right mind knows that the imperialist apparatus is coming, that they have eyes on the Sudan, Somalia, the Horn of Africa that they're trying to chop off, the African continent as a whole, as they're trying to put it in the vortex of their matrixized, geopolitical, militarized intelligence, AFRICOM operation. But if your policy is to go on autopilot or self-destruct yourself against your own population, then you, of course, help this process of destabilization, because at the end of the day, the cartoon clique does not have an answer for the majority of the people's interests, because they're just a self-serving clique that thrives off of the divide and conquer and thrives off their own sustainability. Ever since they, in the NIF, National Islamic Front, performed a coup to get into power in the first place, thwarting a peace settlement with the South, who was resisting against Islamic State rule. Then they charted off to an Arab conference, Bashir and company, in Iraq. And when they returned, with the full support of the Arab states, said no peace deal with the South, thus thrusting the country in a horrible destabilizing conflict that lasted for 20 more years and ended up being, of course, part of the vulnerable underbelly of the Sudan population as a whole and its stability because of the policies of a tiny elite clique of Arab supremacists and Abrahamic dominating vultures. Here, Obscuri describes what has happened to his own affected community in the Sudan on the River Nile.
Outside Sudan, when I started the campaign, because we couldn't work inside Sudan in the early 90s because of security measures, because whoever stand up to say no or try something will be detained, and I've been prosecuted, so I moved to London. I started this campaign from there. But my colleague, my relative, the member of the committee that represents the affected people, have been detained, they have been tortured, they have been laid off their jobs, etc. And these, you know, measures that any dictator will do against innocent people. And eventually, they attacked the affected communities when they were having a peaceful meeting in a school courtyard, and killed three and injured more than 40. It's about one in late February, because the Dam Authority want to move a part of our community to the desert. And in Northern Sudan, the average temperature is like 44 Celsius. So the people don't want to go to the desert. The people choose to remain around the Lake Delvoa because of the water. So we agreed with the Nile State that resettlement project should be around the reservoir. And this project, which we call Al-Fida, is a desert project. We agreed that this project should be stopped, should not be implemented, and the money that is available for resettlement project should be spent on a project around the lake. However, as I said earlier, they don't honor the agreement. They started this desert project, and because of that violation of the agreement, the affected communities decided to help or to hold a peaceful protest in the nearby town. And during this time, this project has a big security unit, you know, like an army. So the dam security attacked, tried to assassinate two of the leaders of the protest.
So once again, we can see the typical process of how these games play out with this ruling clique. As Askeri said, he couldn't work inside of the Sudan. People being detained, tortured, laid off from their jobs. You know, as I mentioned before on other Sudan programs, when the National Islamic Front performed its coup July 4th, 1989, there was plans for the peace conference set for July 18th, 1989. The RCC, which was the Revolutionary Command Council under Bashir, then banned all political parties, trade unions, free press, and it imprisoned political opponents. It fired 20,000 government employees, including army officers, judges, university teachers, and workers, and replaced them with National Islamic Front members and supporters. So this is how they've always consolidated their power. You play by their rules, under their identity, or your ass out. This is how, when you're just a little third world country, you stay vulnerable for penetration. Now, right now, at least 40% of Sudan's oil sales goes to China. They recently purchased 10 Russian MiG-29s. These are fighter jets, extremely advanced. Now, Sudan's debt to China is up to 2001 was $67.3 million. China wrote off 67% of the debt in 2001. So these fighter jets and all of this stuff, these aren't used and purchased for outside forces. This is bought and purchased and used for its internal bludgeoning of its population so that it can maintain rule and monopolize power and control. As this dam is being set up, the Arab clique, as they identify themselves, Bashir, president, popular slogan, and call that for Arab nationalism, is one of his favorite quotes. In other words, I'm saying this is because the reason why I call him Arab, regardless of skin color, is because they call themselves Arab. And also, many of them have created this lineage, whether true or not, to this, like, Muhammad's uncle and all of this type of stuff. So you have this cultural vortex and clash going on, which the clique identifies with and exploits to the till. But what should also be noted is that many Arab Islams want to have it both ways. They often say that these conflicts going on, like in Darfur, are intra-ethnic African conflicts. Yet at the same time, they personally themselves, more often than not, and all these various Arab states and leaders and people throughout the Middle East recognize Sudan as an Arab state and include it as being part of the Arab League. So how are you having, if your argument is that these are just Africans conflicting amongst themselves, like in Darfur, and that Bashir is just, you know, black himself, how is it that the Sudan is recognized as an Arab state? How is it an Arab state without any Arabs? See, when it comes to the conflict, the negative issues against the masses of people, they all become Africanized. When it becomes the exploitive aspects of elite cliques, then the Arabness is recognized within the state. Meanwhile, as I said, Bashir is constantly calling out, quote, Arab unity, Arab nationalism. When black folks from the southern region drifted into Khartoum because of the long battles and wars, various officials were going on record decrying this, saying that it was, quote, polluting the purity of Arab Sudan, unquote. So this isn't just, quote unquote, Western powers talking about Arab, quote, African conflicts. People who know about this area, region, history know this has long been going on and exploited. It's time for at least some, if possible, of these hypocrites to be somewhat real about this. And one of the powers of these guys using, one, the Arab supremacist theology and the religious theology of supremacy, which is part of an Abrahamic construct, is that the Abrahamic religions are hierarchical orders. They're hierarchical social, political, cultural indicators and organizing apparatuses. So it's all too welcoming to help for the elites to put their masses into their fold for their particular interests, which they quite often do. Now also, recently in June 18th, 2007, in Reporters Sans Frontières out of Paris, it had an article called Four Journalists Arrested While Traveling to Cover Violent recently suppressed dam protest. Some of it goes like this. Reporters Without Borders have condemned the continuing detention of four journalists employed by Khartoum-based daily newspapers who were arrested in Dongola in the state of Somalia North on June 17, 2007, while on their way to cover a protest against the building of the dam in the Kajavar region. Quote, does the Sudanese government think it can conceal embarrassing news by jailing journalists? Unquote. The Press Freedom Organization asked. Quote, arresting people because of what they have seen or could see is shameful and absurd and violates the undertaking given by the government. There are no grounds for holding these four reporters and they should be free at once. Unquote. Al-Fatia Abdullah of the privately owned daily Al-Sudini and others were arrested as they were traveling in a privately owned vehicle at about 11 p.m. local time, June 13th. They were on their way to Kajar Dam construction site where four people had been killed and at least 10 others wounded when police used violence to disperse a protest by members of the Nubian population opposed to building of the dam. After being questioned about the purpose of their trip, the journalists were detained in Dongola's police station, denied all contact with their newspapers, relatives, or lawyers since their arrest. They have been transferred by the intelligence services to Kobar Prison in Khartoum. So once again, this is how we consistently see these events play out by the Khartoum click government. And what's fascinating is how these things are often interpreted. You know, June 14th, 2007, in What's Left online magazine, Stephen Gowans wrote an article called Will Sudan Be Recolonialized? And this is what he had to say. He goes into a quote, United States is maneuvering to introduce a UN peacekeeping force in Darfur as a first step to securing control of the region's vast supply of oil. U.S. control of Darfur's petroleum resources would deliver highly profitable investment opportunities to U.S. firms and scuttle China's investment in the region, thereby slowing the rise of a strategic competitor whose continued industrial growth depends on secure access to foreign oil. Washington is using highly exaggerated charges of genocide as a justification for a UN intervention it would dominate, while at the same time opposing a workable peacekeeping plan acceptable to the Sudanese government that would see the current African Union mission in Darfur expand. While Sudan's president, Omar Hassan al-Bashir, is often presented as ostensibly opposing the introduction of peacekeepers in Darfur, Sudan has already accepted an AU force, urges the strengthening of the current AU mission, but opposes its replacement by Western troops. Bashir's fear is that a Western military presence will become permanent and that Sudan, the first country south of Sahara to gain independence, will be the first country to be recolonialized. Now, let me stop right there for a sec. Now, while of course Sam is playing out its geopolitical interest for control and usurpation of China's influence in the region, here's the other reality that's going on. June 2007, the Arab leaders of Khartoum hosted an intelligence summit in the capital of the Sudan called the Committee for Intelligence and Security Systems in Africa, CISSA, which operates under the African Union, what Gowan just talked about. At least 46 Sambo African agencies were there, along with their Western imperial masters, British Secret Service representatives, and yes, senior CIA. This is all a scam. Sudan is working, the cartoon clique is working and operating with U.S. intelligence. They're in the same bed. It's not that they are don't try to cut each other's throat, but they're playing on the same chessboard game of privatized market interest, covert operation, trading secrets with one another. The U.S. is working with the Sudan in its operations in the war on terror, and is very happy with the Khartoum Arab clique government's involvement and investment in this whole operation. So how are you going to pretend that you're in opposition to the tyranny of the imperial order of the West, and at the same time be bedfellows with its intelligence military apparatus? It's a scam. Once again. Now also, you have the various developments of this long-standing operation between them. And this is something that they all know and talk about, at least amongst themselves, constantly. Now, continuing on with Gowan's article. There is no shortage of turmoil in Darfur for Western troublemakers to exploit. Conflicts over water and grazing have raged for decades between sedentary farmers and nomadic tribes. And now there's a new flashpoint. Who will reap the benefits of the region's newfound oil resources? Well, we know who plans to. The Arab clique in governmental control. Also, what should be noticed is that a lot of the stresses that the land is under is through the clique's policy of intentional underdevelopment. And one of the underdevelopment things that they're doing currently is this mega-sized dam that's going to stress out the resources and the habitat even more. So they further stress out the land through these super dam projects, which will only intensify the poverty of the masses of people. But since they're not concerned with the masses of people's well-being, only to exploit the masses of people's well-being to their particular interests. And often they're ruling by chaos, in a similar way that the U.S. empire is creating more chaos in the region of the Middle East with their ally partners, Israel and Lebanon, all this madness, this Salvadorian operation that's going on in the region. This is by design to create intra-conflict within the populations so that they can express their interest in the long run even more so. Well, by the same token, the Khartoum's government's consolidation of underdevelopment with its succession of sectarian military and civilian Arab governments plays a role in destroying within the private construct any form of cohesion and development for the masses of people in the region. have consistently done stuff where they have absentee landlords who are within their fold allow land to go by the wayside, similar to, you know, areas where like in South America. So their policies are not designed to help develop the whole of the society. It's designed to create as much wealth for the ruling clique in the given society as much as possible. In the same way that you see what's taking place in on America's plantation, where you see all this outsourcing of jobs, the intellectual disintegration of the educational apparatus in all of its forms. We all know that a core part of the educational process is for control mentally, but just the basic schooling is deteriorating. Hey, this is under the under development of a industrial society taking place. But even though it's under development taking place, healthcare, adding to the deterioration of the masses of people in the society, the profits have never been greater for the rulers. So the development of the masses of people is not their interest. It's the development and expansion of their privatized interests. And this is what the clique in the Sudan is based and locked into, like many of these other barbaric societies. Now, also, you have the Sudan, when Darwin talks about how who will reap the benefits of the region's newfound oil resources. You know, years back, Sudan installed a scorched earth policy against the Nuer and Dinka people, the main groupings of the Africans in a particular region. That was a classic imperial-like example of depopulation against a people for resource-based reasons. Most of the oil in that region that was being produced were in the Sudan's Upper Nile area, where the Dinkas and Nuers are located. And basically, the policies that followed were that the Arab clique decided to push out the population, scorch the earth, make it uninhabitable as much as possible, and thereby set up their pipelines and everything else as they wanted, because they didn't want the population to be a part of sharing in the resources. This is a clique that's all in it for themselves. One of the historical problems that the Sudan has had, as I've mentioned before, is that the Sudan is not like America 2007. Sudan is more like America 1840. In other words, many of the populations in these various regions still have their identity to the land and the region that is not within the fold of the Arab clique in power. In other words, there's the Nuba Mountains and their historical tie by the Nuba people. You have the southern people of the Sudan, the Darfurians, so on and so forth. This is more like how many of the native aboriginals in America saw themselves while the American experiment was going on and expanding. So one of the great tools that you need to do to those people who see themselves within their own identity and historical frame of reference is, in the American context, Americanize and Christianize them. In the Sudan context, is Arabicize and Islamicize them. In other words, deconstruct their historical outlook, identity, frame of reference, and put it into an Arab and an Islamic frame of reference. So the land that they consider sacred, in the case of the Dakotas, the Black Hills, or for the Nubas, the Nuba Mountains and other regions and other people, et cetera, will no longer be these sacred areas because they will see themselves through the lens of Arab Islam. So Mecca will all of a sudden take precedence over it, and the clique in power will then be able to destroy the resources, destroy the region, I should say, exploit the resources with little to no conflict. In the same way that for them, as the Arab clique sees themselves, the destruction of Nubia, even though it's in the Sudan, means nothing to them because of their whole frame of reference. Even though it's a cornerstone of African history and in Africa and throughout the diaspora. But the clique does not see themselves as being part of that. You know, so it's easy for them within their frame of reference and mentality, also coming from an imperial, privatized, monopolistic standpoint, it's easy for them to carry out themselves in the way they do from their supremacist viewpoints of the world. So within these scorched earth policies that are a continuous policy of the clique in power, which basically parallels the Western imperialist policies in the regions of like the Congo, where they're doing a scorched earth policy, this process that the Nuers and Dinkas have faced have been going on in the Upper Nile and began in 1998. Hundreds of thousands of villagers were forced out by state-sponsored Islamic Arab supremacist terrorist policies. And the regions of the people of the Western Upper Nile and Eastern Upper Nile were burnt out. This is how the game is played. It just takes place in different ways. Whether we're in New Orleans, Harlem, Nubia, the Upper Western Nile, or Eastern Western Nile, or Iraq. The scorched earth policies of the privatized barbarians is very similar. Now, continuing on with Gowen's article. In other places, the practice of the United States, Britain, Germany, and other Western powers has been to inflame tensions within countries whose resources and cheap labor make them attractive targets for economic takeover, or whose public policies block or impose conditions on foreign investments and trade. The turmoil is often used as a pretext for intervention. While the real reasons for intervention are inexorably bound up with profit-making opportunities, the stated reasons are inevitably presented as being related to selfless humanitarianism. This was true of the Nazis, who said they were intervening militarily in countries across Europe to rescue oppressed German minorities and to save the continent from communism, as it is of the United States today, which we are expected to believe, can't afford to provide health care to all its citizens, but can spend countless billions on war to deliver democracy and freedom to non-citizens halfway across the globe. Now, while of course this is true, this at the same time is what the clique in power play into by only being concerned with their elite domination, which, since they see and know themselves as a minority, they have no interest in giving the autonomy to the masses and the people, or sharing the resources of the land of the people on any kind of equal footing. They want to control and privatize it for themselves. So the sword becomes the policy of the clique in power, which quite naturally is going to be exploited by outside imperial forces. Once again, what you do matters. In the nation Nairobi by Ophia McDoon, June 21st, 2007, an article was called "A Failed State Depends Where You Live." Some of it goes like this. With 8 lane highways adorned by huge television screens advertising Sudanese companies, Khartoum does not appear to fit the image of capital of the world's most failed state. But an index published by the U.S.-based foreign policy magazine on Monday placed Sudan at the top of such a list, ahead of even Iraq and Somalia. Arriving in Khartoum's pristine refurbished airport terminal, visitors are greeted by a huge glass Toyota showroom with the newest model vehicle, testament to Sudan's new oil wealth, pumping more than 500,000 barrels per day. High-speed wireless is available. Mobile network compete for new customers, and cafes serving French pastries has sprung up throughout Khartoum, one of the safest capitals in Africa. But analysis attributed to that the strength of the security apparatus in Khartoum, the base of the government, and the city's wealth is in connection and concentration of international businesses. Outside Khartoum is a different story. There, the foreign policy index begins to make more sense. Foreign policy researchers use indicators such as public services, human rights, security apparatuses, displaced populations, territorial control and relations with the international community to measure a state's success or failure. It found Sudan was the most failed state in areas of numbers of refugees and displaced persons, group grievances against the state, and the gelamentizing of the state and human rights abuses. The primary cause of Sudan's instability, violence in the country's western region of Darfur, is a well-known as it is tragic, foreign policy said. It added that Darfur's violence has affected Chad and Central Africa's Republic, which have suffered as the conflict spilled over the border. Chad is number 4 on the list, and the CAR number 10. The spillover effects from Sudan have a great deal to do with the country's tumble in the rankings, demonstrating that the dangers of failing states often bleed across borders, the magazine said. Outside the rapidly developing city center, Khartoum's sprawling slum suburbs, home to millions who have fled regional conflict throughout Africa's largest country, do not have electricity, running water, or proper health care. In the peripheral regions, the situation is worse. A Darfur peace deal has done little to quell violence in Sudan's west, where international experts estimate 200,000 have been killed. An eastern peace deal has seen little progress. And in the north, violence has erupted as authorities try to move people from the land they want to flood to build a dam. The conflicts have forced some 7 million people from their homes. Now, the reason why I mention this is that The Sudan clique in power has no problem with a failed state within this context. In the same way that SAM has no problem with failed states in certain regions where they're creating chaos. They want chaos and a failed state for the masses of people. In many ways, the American empire is a failed state for the majority of this population. It's just not framed that way and looked at that way. But if you're running around with no health care and you need an operation and you live in an industrialized society like this, and other industrialized societies are more than capable and ready to fill the needs of its population in similar situations, then that's a failed society for large portions of the masses. 30 million plus in America who have no health care at all, and the millions that do, the health care system doesn't even work. It's all a scam. It's a failed state system. But that's not a problem for those who are the rulers and the administrators for them. That's a success. A failed state for these rulers who don't see themselves being ousted out of control is not a failed state for them. It's a successful state. It's a state that's doing its job, that's crushing the masses of its people while still staying in power and still maintaining its legitimacy. That's the reality. So these things have to be put into context. Now, continuing on with Godwin's little article, he goes, true to form, Washington declares the conflict in Darfur to be a genocide, another intervention, a finding that compels international action. But Washington quietly reveals his true motivations in an executive order to strengthen sanctions on Sudan, which cites, quote, the pervasive role played by the government of the Sudan in Sudan's petroleum and petrochemical industries. Unquote, unquote. Washington then declares Sudan's control of Sudanese petroleum resources to be a threat to, quote, U.S. national security and foreign policy interests, unquote. Now, of course, SAM is playing all of his games. But then, a simple question to Godwin and Bashir. Why is the Sudan government working with U.S. intelligence? I mean, this is, you know, if you know these things are going on and you're in true full-scale opposition to what another country's trying to do, then why are you cooperating with them on the under on other issues and on similar overlapping issues? Because all of these guys are crooked to the core, and because who's an enemy one day within the privatized construct can be an ally the next day. So it's not really the policies that drive the conflict. In other words, Bashir and the clique in power in Sudan do not have a problem with SAM's imperialist policies. It's just how and where they're directed. And if they can maneuver within those guidelines, the U.S. Empire can kill off as many people as it wants, as long as it serves the Sudan's interests. And the Sudan clique can kill off as many people as it wants, as long as it serves U.S. interests, and neither one will blink an eye. So it's not the policy of privatized domination and destruction that foments this chaos that either sides have a policy, a problem with. It's just the geopolitical grand chessboard maneuvering that they're doing. And sometimes they're playing on the same side of the chess pieces. Continuing on with Godwin's article, two realities suggest that it is the U.S. foreign policy interest, which is to say the interests of the banks, corporations, and hereditary capitalist families which dominate policy making in Washington, and not genocide, that shapes U.S. policy on the Sudan. No kidding. But once again, what you do matter. See, let's look at a place like Cuba. Even though Cuba has many problems and issues, the one thing that the CIA has never been able to exploit on the Cuban issue is any kind of black conflict. I'm not saying things are racially perfect in Cuba, but the government and society of Cuba do not intentionally overexploit the black population of Cuba like the Khartoum government, the Arab elite clique, intentionally does, thereby giving an avenue for outside forces to exploit. If you look at all of the Cuban opposition forces in Miami and elsewhere, 99.9% of them are mestizos and white, no Negroes. But it never dawns on these slobs how it's so easy for forces to get traction in places like the Sudan and not other places like Cuba. What you do internally matters. But if you don't care about large portions of the population, you can't be surprised when these types of things are exploited by internal and external forces. Now, continuing on, Godwin also says, first, while there has unquestionably been a large number of violent deaths in Darfur, there has never been a genocide. This is not to say that Khartoum isn't guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity. It may just be securely enhanced in the club of war criminals countries as the U.S., Britain, and Israel. But on the matter of genocide, the UN Commission on Darfur was quite clear. There had been no genocide in Darfur, notwithstanding Washington's allegations. What there has been is a disproportionate response by Khartoum to attacks by rebel groups on police stations and government buildings. And while that response has targeted entire groups, it has not been aimed at eliminating them. Now let me stop right there for a sec. One of the things that should be noticed is that the way in a history of how the response by the Khartoum government has taken place in the Sudan has a long history to it. And what I mean by that is that you have a situation where you know, you've had cats like Mahmoud Madami, who wrote the thing called The Politics of Naming, and he also goes into this, is Darfur genocide that has happened and must be punished, or is it genocide that could happen and must be prevented? Now, he's on the side that this must be prevented. Now, what happens with cats like Madami and Gowan is that they keep approaching these issues and incidents as individual events. Even though we have, there's a lineage from the dam projects to Southern Sudan to Nubia to the Nuba Mountains to Darfur and beyond. The constant thread of actions in social, economic, and cultural, ethnic, religious programs and relationships to the larger society by the elite clique in power. The rights of land, autonomy, the rights to employment, education, and what forms those educational and employment institutions are based in. Often these various individuals, when they just talk about particular events, they ignore the larger historical relationship and how these counterinsurgency policies in the Sudan context are a part of their overall far-reaching goals, the Arabicization, like I said before, and how this process has played out throughout the years. So you have a situation where these guys know politically what they're doing in this development and how their policies help foment the continuous decline of the overall health of the population. It's a constant badgering and constant underdevelopment of the population at whole that is left without large amounts of resources and left in a continuous amount of chaos. Meanwhile, you have people like Condoleezza Rice, who will make statements like this when she wrote in 2005 in a letter to Bashir, the president of the Sudan, where she was talking about hoping to see the end of the conflict in Darfur, but also stated that she wanted the Bush administration's to keep establishing a quote fruitful relationship and look forward to a continuing quote close cooperation on terrorism unquote. Now the reason why I mention this again is to show that the Sudanese government is playing all sides on this. Because for them, it's not about the interest of the masses of the people. It's not about being anti-imperialism or being anti-genocidal themselves or being in conflict with state apparatuses that are against, that are fomenting or operate in genocidal modes. It's about staying in power. That's what guides them. And for countries in Africa who operate in that mode and operate within those clique setups, for the whole of the African continent especially, that's a policy of defeat. You set the whole continent up for continuous destabilization because your principles are basically based on you staying in power, you maintaining your power at the expense of the masses. Thereby, the masses are continuously left in a form of chaotic disruption, and they're basically in just basic survival mode. Thereby, it makes the whole region more vulnerable for penetration. So what these little cliques do in the Sudan and beyond helped foment penetration by the imperialist order. This is what these little Jai Time researchers that love to go on and on about the U.S. Overall policy, anyone with half a head on knows the U.S. overall policy. But as I keep stressing, what you do in your own country matters. And if your policies are based in your own privatized controlling clique, in other words, you basically emulating the larger Western powers, well, one thing, you not only make the whole region that you're in vulnerable, but you basically punch a time clock for yourself. Because sooner or later, that hourglass runs out on you, like it ran out on Noriega, like it ran out on Saddam, like it ran out on Mobutu, and you'll find you're behind being kicked out one way or another, one technique or another. But the overall population, which really is what counts, is often left that much more vulnerable. Just like in the case of Iraq. So unless these things are put into this context, all of this babbling on about what Western interests are and all that, as if we don't know. You know, and anyone who's against the imperial order, of course, does not want any form of U.S. intervention, U.N. intervention, or any of that type of nonsense. But at the same time, many of these cliques in power in Africa are so wretched that that's exactly what they're setting the countries up for. In the WorldNet Daily, by Jerome Kurosi, an article came out called "Now Africa Heads Towards Continental Government." Some of it goes like this. Advancing the movement towards economic and political globalism, the African Union is moving down the path of regional economic integration, with the expected end result of continental economic and political integration. On July 11, 2000, at the Lome Summit in Togo, the states constituting the Organization of African Unity signed a declaration to form 53-nation African Union. While the African Union professes to respect the sovereignty of the individual countries constituting the group, it still has created executive, legislative, and judicial bodies required for regional government, including an African Union Executive Council, a Pan-African Parliament, and an African Union Court of Justice. Now, the reason why I mentioned some of this is because the U.S. is behind this. And what these knuckleheads are doing is allowing themselves to be reshuffled into a modern day colonialized economic, political, geo, stratum, collective. This is not for the interest of the people of Africa. Now, you will most probably get certain cliques in these various societies, countries, ferment and consolidate their power more as it becomes part of a more powerful network under the spear of the U.S. but the masses of people's life and life expectancy will continue to go down. Yet these fools, or I can't even say fools, is these enemies are walking right into this because their interests are not the same as the whole. So defending Bashir and them is basically defending an element of the privatized network that does not have the interest of the masses of people. There are no good players involved in this, from China to Sam to the Sudan. Now, going back to Oscuri, let's hear Oscuri talk about China's relationship with the NIF, Khartoum Arab Elite Clique.
China now is the main supporter of the Sudan government. It has a huge investment, and it's up to $10 billion U.S. dollar that China invests in Sudan, in oil, in dam, and transport, and other sector of the economy. Sudan government depend utterly on the China support in the international arena for protection, you know, for to avoid measures from Security Council and in different area in international politics. So the China is heavily involved in this project. They are making, they are spending or investing about $1 billion U.S. dollar pound, and there are about $5 billion in the oil sector that they are building bridges, roads and airport. The problem is not bad when you look at face. It's not bad on face value to build bridge or whatever. But the thing is that these projects are not studied, and the way they are distributed is distributed like for the official. It is not where they are needed. They are being built, like, for example, they are building part of this dam. They are building the fourth biggest airport, international airport in Africa, and that is in a town with a population about 6,000. This town is the town of the dam chief executive. So that's how the Chinese government distributed his project. If you work with them, then, you know, they repay you in this type of project. And many projects they don't have economic justification. They are just being built or implemented to appease, you know, the official who deal with them.
So as I mentioned before, the fourth biggest airport in Africa is being built in a town of around 6,000 people. Once again, this is payola. It's buying allegiance externally from China. And the good Arabs who align themselves with the Bashir clique are being paid off by the Islamic State for their loyalty. But it does no good for the region at all. This is just like, the IMF and the World Bank building these projects and doing these things. Basically, in cahoots with these various despotic rulers in Africa that don't help the masses of people, but these loans and what have you help serve and further cement the various kleptocracy states, cadres within their folds, loyalty and stuff. So this is how these processes continue to develop, and in reality underdevelop, as Oscuri outlines. Next, much of the affected community's position on the dam and some of the response.
The affected communities are not against the dam. They say if the dam will bring benefit to the country, that's fine. But we should not be relocated to the desert, 40 kilometers off the riverbank. All we want is to be relocated or resettled around the lake, because it is impossible to survive in the desert in northern Sudan. The government, rather than say thank you to the affected community, the government says, you have to accept the dam, and on top of that, you have to go to the desert. And that's what triggers the conflict. The conflict now is not about the dam. The conflict is about resettlement. The government wants to take the affected communities to the desert, while the affected communities chooses to remain by near the water. And it's really hurting, because the Chinese are also involved even in this local issue. The Chinese are the ones building these projects in the desert. Projects in the desert are being built by Chinese companies. Not only they're not only building them, they are building these resettlement houses, etc., in the desert.
So once again, this is leave and die. It's not just leave or die. It's leave and die. Now, if any of these people end up becoming rebels, many hypocrites would start automatically, you know, claiming they have CIA ties, they're working with the Zionists and all of this. But in reality, it's just human beings facing the wrath of a barbaric state who sees them as disposable. Now, many of these affected people consider themselves Arab. That's what they call themselves. So that's what I call them. But it's not an issue for me of whether or not I support them. Of course I do. Because it's based off of their basic human rights. That's the whole thing. But many Arab supremacists and many Islamic supremacists who cry about these types of radical analysis on their system and ideology and what's taking place in the Sudan have basically painted themselves in a corner on this issue, because many of them have not wanted to criticize the Arab clique regime in power. And now the pigs have come home to roost. Your own pig juice of contradiction is squirting in your eyes. Because now you have a situation that by many of these people in these various societies and in America who have aligned themselves and tried to justify Bashir and them's response in the region and how they've gone about their particular business, and just try to say it's just a foreign intervention policy by the U.S. and Zionists and all of that, have now seen what has always been the case. Arab supremacy in Sudan is similar to like white supremacy in America. It's an elite construct. Now, you can be poor and broke down as a white person and still align yourself with it, but that doesn't mean you're going to get the benefits of the elite construct. It just means you serve its purpose to help beat down other people who are in that category and stuff. You know, but you're not going to benefit as part of the elite clique, and you too may find one day a boot up your behind. Whether it's in the form of having your pensions cut off in America, even though you're white, and now that parachute is ripped from you and you come falling head first into the earth, or whether it's in the form of being an Arab in the Sudan and finding yourself in this particular case being considered disposable by the clique because they have other goals and interests and they got money to make. So your Arab identity doesn't serve any purpose in this particular case, so you ass out too. That's how it works in the real world. But those who align themselves with the elite's ideology and construct are often victims to this. Now, it's well known that with these large dam projects, malaria, Rift Valley fever, AIDS, you know, the real AIDS, which in the African context is basically has nothing to do with HIV, is whether you have malaria, dry cough, wasting diseases, etc., etc. That's going by the Banqui definition. So it ain't got nothing to do with sex or that's all jive. It's just poor living conditions and deteriorating life standards. But the wildlife area, all these areas, downstream populations, irrigation problems, furthering stressing of the land and populational groupings, depriving of silt brought by the river floods into areas, all of these things that are most probably going to happen are being ignored by the clique in power, because it's all about power, money, resources. And the fact that this will stress the populations even more so, they'll just use some more divide and conquer tricks. And unfortunately, many people will go for it. So, one would ask, why is there no environmental impact assessment?
Government and the Dam Authority are, I believe, the Chinese and the funders that are, because there are funds, you know, that are financing this project as well, like the Kuwait Fund, the Saudi Fund, the Abu Dhabi Fund, the Sultanate of Oman. These are all, you know, giving money to this project. They thought that they can get this dam built, and by the time the world hear about it, it would have been completed. That's why they don't like our activity, our, you know, writing, our talking. They don't like it this at all. And that's why they didn't do an environmental impact assessment. They assume that they will do this in 1 or 2 years, and, you know, nobody hear about it, because they believe that the affected community are poor. They don't have somebody to speak for them. They don't know the outside world. But I'm glad to say that we with the support, massive support we get from organizations like International River Network and Corner House in the United Kingdom and other international NGOs, we managed to, you know, get our voice to outside world. So many years of working on this campaign, I would say with confidence that this is a political project. It's a project that is meant to support some influential ruling individual that represent one tribal group that dominates the state. That's all. If you look at it from another angle, these communities, affected communities, who are more, as I said, more than 50,000, they only got a job, a driver job. The only job they got on the project is a driver. So, you would see, this is about $2 billion US dollar being spent on this project, and the affected communities can only get a driver job. It is not only because the affected communities do not have engineers or economists or accountant or technician. They do have. We have qualified people. But as I said, this is a political project. It is the main objective is to support and make chances, opportunities for a certain group in Northern Sudan. And this group dominates the state.
So what we've seen is Qatar, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, other Arab states along with China are all involved in helping fund this dam and wanted it funded before anyone really knew what was going on. Now, we know China's interest in this whole policy at the connections I've drawn, but at the same time, you have the various Arab states. These are just elite cliques protecting their own Arab brothers. Elite brothers. The masses be damned. Because for many of the dispossessed around this damn project who identify themselves as Arabs, they obviously aren't concerned about their displacement and them being told to go and die in the desert. Because the way the construct of elitism within Sudan is set up, the Arab identity is a supremacist construct. And while you can, as a self-identifying Arab peasant, can bark about the inferior Zurga, you know, black Abids, the slaves, the black slaves, and all of that type of stuff, to get your little rocks off and stuff, at the end of the day, for the elite clique in power, the masses are Abids. From the Sudan to the supremacist order in America. But if you're dumb enough to identify with the white construct in America or the Arab supremacist construct in the Sudan, well, then the genocidal elite, they got you. And it's clear they got many bozos around the world. Greenhouse gases, algae, all of these things will be taking place. John Vidal wrote an article in The Guardian UK, July 18, 2007, Dust, Waste, and Dirty Water, the Deadly Price of China's Miracle. Quote, hundreds of millions of people are being made ill every year or dying prematurely from pollution caused by China's breakneck economic growth. A leading economic think tank has concluded following an 18-month investigation. The OECD study, prepared at China's request, draws on work by the government, World Bank, and Chinese Academy of Science to spell out the scale of the ecological crisis now engulfing the country, poisoning its people and holding it back economically. It says up to 300 million people are drinking contaminated water every day. 190 million are suffering from water-related illnesses each year. If air pollution is not controlled, it says there will be 600,000 premature deaths in urban areas and 20 million cases of respiratory illness a year within 15 years. China's water quality gives the researchers greatest concern. One-third of the length of all China's rivers are now highly polluted, quote-unquote, as are 75% of its major lakes and 25% of all its coastal waters. Nearly 30,000 children die from diarrhea due to polluted water each year. That's the reality of how these market systems truly work. And now, China, with his sidekick. Now China, who admits that many of its own dams are, quote, time bombs, unquote, and a danger to people living downstream. Now they're engaged in Africa. And the cliques in power have no interest or concern about what the future holds. And the crushing of history in the Nuba region holds for humanity. As this Marwa Dam, at least 50 miles in length, and 240 square miles in surface, is set to engulf black ancient history and future in the same way that they washed away New Orleans and are attacking us all over the planet, especially in Africa. Hold on a sec.
Full spectrum dominance. They've been going on in Africa for the most part. You know, AFRICOM is just a recent reorganization and proliferation, further expansion of U.S. military operations on the continent. So before, for example, we had CENTCOM, Central Command, EUCOM out of Stuttgart, Germany, which is European Command, and PACCOM or PACIFICCOM, the Pacific Command based out of Hawaii. And those three were responsible for certain large areas of Africa. And then there was a deep connection to South Africa, the U.S. military connection to South Africa. So now they've all been consolidated under one command. And this has been going on, this consolidation has been going on secretly for the last 4 or 5 years, but just openly been announced to be AFRICOM. And so AFRICOM will take the place of CENTCOM, which and EUCOM, and then PACIFICCOM. PACIFICCOM was formerly responsible for Madagascar, Comoros, and the Seychelles, the three islands off the coast of East Africa in the south. And of course, you know, people should be aware that Madagascar, when we talk about PACIFICCOM, Madagascar currently has a major mining operation undertaken by Barrick Gold Corporation, with George Bush Sr. as one of the advisors and Brian Mulroney, the former Prime Minister of Canada. So when we talk about military control of places like Madagascar, we're talking about, you know, making sure that we can get at our mining interests or our oil interests or our other intelligence, surveillance, and clandestine operations that are going on, you know, in Africa for these resources, for control of these resources. The Pentagon's involvement in Africa, for example, in Djibouti, in Sudan, in Eritrea, in Uganda, in Djibouti, and Ethiopia today are the biggest concentrations of American military power on the continent. And this is, you know, the concentrations are extremely significant. In Djibouti, for example, the Joint Task Force for the Horn of Africa in Djibouti has thousands of U.S. covert operations soldiers who are responsible for committing snatch-and-grab black operations in Somalia, for example, or in Sudan, or in Eritrea, or in Uganda, or in Rwanda, or in Congo, and Uganda as well, major base of U.S. military support on the continent and alliances with Museveni, the president of Uganda. And that's why, for example, we hear about certain conflicts and certain so-called humanitarian disasters. They are humanitarian disasters, but people need to be aware of the fact that some disasters, humanitarian disasters, are amplified, magnified, and brought into our awareness and our attention through psychological operations, and other disasters are completely off the radar screen. So Darfur, for example, is on the radar screen. It's a massive psychological operation against the American public today, and against, of course, people in Africa on a military level. But northern Uganda, the conflict in northern Uganda, is completely off the radar, absolutely and completely in blackout or whiteout. And we're talking about, you know, the life and death of hundreds of thousands of people trapped on these concentration camps, which have been set up by the Museveni government with the alliance of the United States military. And these people are subject to horrible, horrible conditions and rape by Ugandan soldiers. But all we ever hear about, if we hear about anything out of Uganda, is the Lord's Resistance Army, this so-called terrorist Christian fanatical organization that's committing atrocities and taking little children. I mean, you read this in Vanity Fair and New Yorker, but you don't get the full story, which is that the biggest atrocities are being committed by the Ugandan government.
And if you're pulverizing your own population, segregating them, declaring holy wars on segments because they don't bend their knees into the feces of Allah or Muhammad, pushing people out into the desert, having military pacts with other reactionary regimes like Sudan has with Ethiopia, aligning yourself with Sam and his Imperial Holy Crusades in the Intelligence Operation Imperial Order, and host other intelligence imperial terrorists in your own backyard or state capital. You are by design rolling out the red, white, and blue imperial colonialist carpet to the order. The great human disaster is the market order disaster. The market order system is the great psychological operation. beyond all else. But I guess for some, you still got Islam. Until next time, slave out.